Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In Yemen, at least 11 civilians, including women and children, have been killed in an apparent new airstrike in the north of the country. The attack on Wednesday, the second in days, also injured five youngsters and a woman in Al-Musafa, Al-Marazik, east of Al-Hazm in Al-Jaf. The actual number of victims is likely to be higher, according to Lise Grandi, UN humanitarian coordinator in the war-torn country, whose office said that the injured had been taken to hospital in Sana'a. For the second time this week, women and children have been wantonly killed and injured in an attack, Ms. Grandi said in a statement. Amid escalating violence in the country, the UN official reiterated the UN's call for a comprehensive ceasefire, adding that the only chance for Yemen is if the parties take that step. On the 12th of July, an airstrike killed nine civilians and injured another four in Hadjr Governorate in northwest Yemen. During the first 6 months of 2020, nearly 1,000 conflict-related casualties have been reported, according to Ms. Grandi's office. The dangerous legacy of nuclear weapons testing continues to affect many communities, a leading rights expert said on Thursday, on the 75th anniversary of testing in the United States that heralded the nuclear age. In an appeal to governments worldwide to get rid of weapons of mass destruction, UN Special Rapporteur on Toxics, Baskut Tunçak, said that the Trinity tests in New Mexico on the 16th of July 1945 were the prelude to the two horrific explosions suffered by the innocent people of Japan towards the end of the Second World War. They were also followed by the detonation of hundreds of nuclear bombs over vulnerable communities in the Pacific and the disposal of radioactive waste on lands and territories of indigenous peoples. This has created a legacy of nuclear testing that is one of the cruelest examples of environmental injustice witnessed, said Mr. Tunçak, an independent expert appointed by the Human Rights Council in Geneva. From 1946 to 58, 67 nuclear bombs were detonated on the Marshall Islands, he said, the equivalent of more than 1.5 Hiroshima-sized explosions every day for 12 years. Communities have suffered unimaginably from radioactive contamination, and this continues today with the legacy of contamination, illness and anguish, the expert insisted. In French Polynesia, over 200 nuclear tests were conducted over a 30-year period from 1966 to 1996, subjecting inhabitants to associated health and environmental damage, the special rapporteur added. And from Greenland to Alaska, he warned that people continue to suffer from the nuclear testing era. This discrimination should be addressed by all states as part of the discussion on systemic racism and nuclear disarmament, Mr. Tunçak insisted. More than 700,000 women are in prison around the world, and their number is growing much faster than men, the Human Rights Council has heard. In a debate about conditions in detention and how to do more to protect female detainees during the COVID-19 crisis, the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, warned that overcrowding had led to serious harm. Here's Georgette Gagnon, head of field operations and technical cooperation at OHCHR, speaking on Wednesday.
Globally, women represent between 2% and 10% of prison populations, but their numbers are increasing rapidly, more so than the increase of male prisoners. Many women detainees face inhuman and degrading treatment during arrest, interrogation, and in custody, including being stripped, invasive body searches, rape, and threats of rape, so-called virginity testing, and other acts, insults, and humiliations of a sexual nature.
Speakers at the Geneva Forum noted that the pandemic continued to represent a threat to inmates' physical and mental health. Measures to stop transmission were making their sentences much harsher, the council heard, amid reports that only 6% or less of the global prison population had been released to reduce the risk of COVID transmission. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. See if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is Radio for the Rest of Us.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. This is the July 16th, 2020 edition of Free Thought Radio. Noah Gilfillan and Buzz Kemper are engineering the show today from Audio for the Arts, while Annie Laurie and I are hosting from our safer at home makeshift studio in Madison, Wisconsin.
And Free Thought Radio is, as always, the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is a 501c3 educational nonprofit existing as a national group since 1978, working to promote the separation of church and state and to educate the public about non-theists.
Today we're going to talk about the quiet demise of the separation of church and state. We should play some like sad music or something, or like a dirge or something. The quiet demise of the separation of church and state is the title of an article written by three law professors that appeared in the New York Times in late June. Two of those professors, Micah Schwartzman and Nelson Tebbe, will join us today.
And more recently, they wrote an article that appeared in The Atlantic called "The Separation of Church and State is Breaking Down Under Trump." In a few minutes, we'll talk with FFRF attorney Ryan Jane about an FFRF expose hot off the press just today released about secretive White House phone calls that funneled PPP money, Paycheck Protection
Program
money, taxpayer bailouts during the pandemic, to churches and religious organizations, including many of the preachers who support Trump.
So to push back against this unprecedented mixing of state and church, FFRF has put up a billboard in Denver this month. It shows a church on one side and a Capitol building on the other side, separated by the words, "Practice social distancing between church and state."
And that really is the recurring theme of today's show. And we want to thank our member, Monty C. Cleworth, who emailed me and said, "Isn't it time to put up another billboard in Denver?" We worked with him over the years, had such fun working with him, and he is paying for most of it. And Claudette St. Pierre, who's the head of our Denver chapter there, they're also kicking in money. And it just went up this week. It will be up for a whole month. And if you're in the Denver area, you can find this backlit 10-foot by 23-foot billboard on Broadway south of 10th Avenue. And it has a very important message, and we're very grateful to Monty and Claudette for their support and initiative.
So before we get to some serious news here, did you hear that the actor Will Smith is telling people not to vote for godless candidates? That's what he told CNN political commentator Angela Rye on her show On One.
As a country, I would hope that a part of what we're learning right now is the destructive aspects of loveless, godless leadership. Do not elect people that don't have God and love in their hearts.
Well, who's leading the country right now? Someone should remind Will Smith about the millions of godless people who do have enough love to make this world a better place. And in fact, this week is the anniversary of the Seneca Falls Convention, held July 19th and 20th in 1848, the first women's rights convention that started the women's suffrage movement that eventually led to the adoption of the 19th Amendment guaranteeing women's right to vote in the United States. And that movement was spearheaded by a godless woman, Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
So besides the fact that there are millions of good, godless people in the world and in government at all levels, doesn't Will Smith see the harm that's being caused by the so-called good, godly people? Well, that leads us to the shenanigans of the Catholic Church and their big gift from us taxpayers.
Yeah, we tape our weekly show typically on Thursdays, and we did mention, of course, the bailout to churches through the Paycheck Protection Program. Last week, we talked with Andrew Seidel and so on. But we did not have the benefit of the Associated Press expose that ran the next day, last Friday. They exposed the haul of taxpayer funds to Roman Catholic dioceses. And so we've issued a press release about that as well, and we want to talk about that for the rest of this segment. And Dan, you know, there's something called the seven deadly sins that the Catholic Church has promoted, and greed is one of them.
Greed, of course, is one of the big ones.
So let's talk about the Catholic Church.
They tell everyone else not to be greedy.
Sin of greed. So they are one of the biggest beneficiaries of the Paycheck Protection Program and of the churches. The many churches is about $7 billion at least that has gone to religions and faith-based leaders. But about half of that, up to half of that, may have gone to Roman Catholic dioceses. At least $1.4 billion to $3.5 billion, and it may be in excess. And this is shocking, and it isn't a coincidence. The Catholic Church successfully lobbied to be exempted from a Small Business Administration rule that disqualified applicants who had more than 500 workers. So Associated Press noted that without this preferential treatment, many Catholic dioceses would have been ineligible. They aggressively promoted the payroll program, they marshaled their resources, and they got Catholic dioceses, parishes, schools, and other ministries to have approval for at least 3,500 forgivable loans, and we've seen figures that it may be far greater than that. This is what the AP could actually verify, but there were some Catholic sources saying that was a great deal more than that. So nearly 500 loans approved to Catholic entities exceeded $1 million. At least eight were between $5 million and $10 million. Loan recipients of about $200 million included some 40 dioceses that have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in the past few years paying victims through compensation funds or bankruptcy proceedings, and often buying off
victims of sexual abuse
by priests. The Diocesan Fiscal Management Conference has reported that about 9,000 Catholic entities receive loans, and that is more than three times the number of beneficiaries that the AP could identify. So that's why their estimate ranges from $1.4 billion to $3.5 billion. To give you some examples, the Los Angeles Diocese, which has a huge glass temple somewhere.
It's an archdiocese.
Had paid a record $666 billion to settle claims of sexual abuse by more than 500 victims. That was back in 2007. Do you want to know what they did? They bought a lobbyist. They paid a lobbyist $20,000 for a couple of days to lobby Congress so they could get benefits. The payoff, 247 of its 288 parishes, all but one of its 232 parochial schools, received taxpayer forgivable loans. They don't have to pay these back. So these range between $9 million and $23 million. Catholic Charities USA, whose motto must be charity begins at home, they spent $30,000 to lobby Congress. The organization and its member agencies walked off with 110 taxpayer loans of between $90 million and $220 million minimally.
Boy, what a return on your investment. You spend $30,000 and then you get these multi-millions.
Yes, and this money has to go under the Paycheck Protection Program to pay salaries. So as we pointed out last week, and we'll be talking with Ryan Jane, our attorney, in the next segment as well, this is the first time taxpayer money has ever been allowed to be used to pay the salaries of ministers and religious staff for religious purposes. Catholic Charities gets a lot of federal money to contract for services it pays others. Well, that's a little different. This is just pure paying the salaries of ministers and their staff, or paying utilities. That's all it could be used for. But not only did they spend money, some of these different agencies in the Catholic Church in America actually spend money for lobbyists. But then, in late April, when they'd already gotten tons of money, several hundred Catholic leaders got on a conference call and urged President Trump to give even more funds. They'd already secured thousands of loans. And during this call, Trump engaged in electioneering, and he boasted that he was the, quote, best president the Catholic Church has ever seen. This is pure pandering. other massive beneficiaries included the Archdiocese of New York. That archdiocese has created a victim compensation fund to discourage victims from suing. And by the way, they spent millions trying to stop a law from allowing the statute of limitations to be extended. They finally lost. But they spent millions and millions to stop that. And then they're paying off victims. And they got 15 loans of at least $28 million just for top executive offices. Their huge cathedral on Fifth Avenue got money.
Are they trying to say that the pandemic is causing them to lay off people and fire people?
And even if it did, that's not the problem of taxpayers. The Wheeling-Charleston Diocese of West Virginia revealed last year that its then-bishop, Michael Bransfield, embezzled funds and made sexual overtures to priests. That diocese got $2 million in taxpayer loans. Many other dioceses implicated in massive cover-ups of sexual abuse of minors by Catholic officials applied for and got taxpayer funds, including the St. Paul Minneapolis Diocese, the Diocese of Erie, Pennsylvania, and on and on. AP writes that nothing illustrates the Church's aggressive pursuit of funds better than the fact that four dioceses that are in bankruptcy sued the Small Business Administration because its rules prevent the SBA from giving loans to applicants in bankruptcy. So this is grotesque governmental favoritism toward religion, and it's the state's complicity with religious demands that is so egregious. It's as egregious as the raid of taxpayer funds. So we need a new deadly sin, which is the government and taxpayers being forced to subsidize religion, particularly corrupt religion.
We'll talk about this some more in the second half of the show with the law professors who compare the government's treatment to Planned Parenthood with the treatment to the Catholic Church. So stay tuned. FFRF attorney Ryan Jane will tell us about the secret White House phone calls that have funneled billions of dollars to churches. And after that, we will talk with two of the law professors, Micah Schwartzman and Nelson Tebbe, who wrote excellent articles about the demise of the separation of church and state under the Trump administration. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Pinker. In my book, Enlightenment Now, I show that the world has become a better place as reason has been overcoming superstition and tribalism. But the values of the Enlightenment are under attack. That's why I'm a proud member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest association of free thinkers working to keep state and church separate. Please join me in supporting the Freedom From Religion Foundation to ensure that our government is driven not by religion, but by reason.
It ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I am Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we have on the phone with us FFRF staff attorney Ryan Jane, who is part of FFRF's strategic response team. Ryan has suffered through a great many conference calls between the Trump administration and churches. And some of these conference calls were clandestine. And we have a big expose today that you can find on our website. Secret White House calls helped funnel tax money to Trump preachers. You can find that at fffrf.org/news on social media. And we have Ryan on the show to tell us what happened. So welcome back to Free Thought Radio. Ryan?
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. So these were some crazy calls that I got to experience. And yeah, it's one of the more unusual parts of working in the legal department at FFRF that you get assignments like this. So this stems from the White House liaison to faith leaders, which one of the things that was revealed on this call, we started with this, but they've set up faith departments in every single executive agency. So they are deliberately reaching out to churches and faith leaders. And what we learned was that on some of these calls, an initial one was set up by Tony Perkins, who, of course, is kind of a well-known villain. They had President Trump and Vice President Pence on the line. And it turned into, of course, this, you know, praise fest for the administration. So no one's going to keep going to these calls unless you're an ally of the administration. And then what they did is once the COVID crisis hit and there was money that was available to nonprofits, what they did is they set up these calls on the same email lists that are, again, primarily Trump allies. And the calls turned into kind of tutorials, how-to guides on how to make sure that your churches get as much taxpayer money as possible. So they have representatives from the SBA, the Small Business Association, various other cabinet members, high executive officials who are on there taking questions and offering to talk to church leaders afterwards, saying, we have just, you know, billions of dollars of taxpayer money, and we want it to go to churches. So here's how we can get a slice of that cash.
So Ryan, how did you get on that call?
Well, it's a funny story. So we got kind of wind that this these emails were going on, that the liaison was organizing these. So what I did is I sent them an email to ask to be added to it, and for the first time in my life, I changed my email signature. I usually say sincerely, so I held my notes, deleted that, and put in God bless. And that seemed to do the trick. They added me without a second question.
So there was a conference call on the first of these clandestine conference calls took place on April 3rd, and that was just as the Paycheck Protection Program was going into gear. But it was 2 weeks before the Small Business Administration published its final rules that churches would be eligible. So
Correct. Basically,
all of these hundreds of callers, all the hundreds of people on the conference call who were clergy and faith-based leaders, got a scoop. They got this information before anyone else did and before there could be any public reaction, for example.
That's right. Yep, and they were told not only details about the program, but they were assured that there would be all these novel aspects of the program that would allow them to get money in ways that are just completely unprecedented. They said, even though you don't do any social services, all you do is religion, even if you're a sole proprietor, there's only one person in your church, which is you, we will pay your wages with taxpayer dollars.
So this wasn't just a governmental call. It was actually like a church meeting. It started with prayer. On April 3rd, you had to listen to Paula White, which is Trump's spiritual advisor, open the meeting with a prayer. Let's listen to a little of that.
And so I think the best way we could start this call is to start with prayer. And so I'd like to ask Pastor Paula White, our advisor to the White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative, to start us in prayer.
Thank you so much, Jenny. We come to you, God, and we give you thanks for our United States and its government. We believe that skillful and godly wisdom has entered into the heart of our president, and knowledge is pleasant to him. Discretion watches over him. Understanding keeps him and delivers him from evil. God, we just ask for supernatural divine deliverance during this time. We ask that you compass the president, the men and women who make their hearts and ears attentive to godly counsel, and do that which is right in your sight. We pray. Amen.
So Paula White isn't just Trump's spiritual advisor, although he has an evangelical board that she's on. She's actually a paid employee of the White House dealing with faith-based things. So
that's right.
So there was an awful lot of this kind of thing going on at these meetings. It was like a religious meeting.
Yes, and so they had not only Paula White, who typically opens and closes these calls with prayers. They have other pastors speak who are, you know, obviously they know they're talking to other faith leaders. They're going to be talking like it's a church service and, well, talking about how they got government funds. And then to make matters worse and just make the entanglement more intense, they have representatives of the administration on there who also know they're talking to church leaders. And so they'll tell their personal religious story. So you have tons of examples of members of the SBA and various other agencies who are saying, you know, well, I'm a Christian and I always try to do what's going to help me get into heaven and things like that. And it's just like, this is such a strange call to be hosted by the White House. This is not how government calls are supposed to go. And if they're trying to create, if they're going to try to argue that this is open to everybody and we're just getting information out there,
they're really undercutting that when they're running it like a church service.
So there was a second call, and we should point out also that at this April meeting where the church leaders all got this scoop, the SBA had barely awarded anything. So barely anybody had gotten any forgivable loans, businesses, and so on. So this was super early to have a tutorial like this. And then the second call on June 22nd was even more explicit, with churches being urged to apply for PPP funds before the deadline. And we have a focus on the family founder, James Dobson, who's bragged about being a kingmaker, that he can decide who's president. And he's a member of the Trump's Evangelical Advisory Board. He's famously been in Colorado Springs for much of his life. And he now has the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute, which took in a lot of money. So let's listen to him talking about his amazement that he was invited to apply for funds.
This is an Interactive Access Live Town Hall brought to you by the United States Small Business Administration in partnership with the White House. Ladies and gentlemen, what an honor we have today to have with us Dr. James Dobson.
Thank you, Ashley. That's a very kind introduction, and I appreciate the President of the United States, Donald Trump, for being behind this. You know, I have led two faith-based ministries for 43 years, and I have never asked for nor received 1 cent from the federal government. If anybody ever called me and said, well, we're trying to get you to apply for money, I would have said, what else are you trying to sell me? Our own organization, JDFI, has literally been kept solvent this spring and summer by the Paycheck Protection Plan. And we have not asked for a cent from anybody in 6 months because of this program that made it possible for us to remain solvent. But the government in this instance cares about you, and especially those in the faith-based community.
So here's this really wealthy guy, James Dobson's raked in money all his life, and this group took in between $350 and $1 million, and he brags he didn't have to he didn't have to solicit funds for his group because the taxpayers paid for his salary.
Yeah, so are we knew through time that he that this is not how this is supposed to work. He said he never asked for it. He knows that this is unconstitutional.
So, well, you can read more about our expose online at ffref.org/news. Look for the headline, Secret White House Calls Helped Funnel Tax Money to Trump Preachers. Thank you for suffering through these calls, Ryan, so that
Not
we could let the public know what's happening to your tax money promoting
Thank you so
religion.
Much for having me on.
Thank you, Ryan, and we'll have you back as we learn more about this developing situation. Stay tuned. After the break, we're going to talk with law professors Micah Schwartzman and Nelson Tebbe, who wrote articles in the New York Times and The Atlantic about the demise of the separation of church and state under the Trump administration. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
Hello, this is Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. With President Trump's appointments to the Supreme Court, we are seeing that the separation of state and church has rarely been under such attack.
Three law professors, Micah Schwartzman, Richard Schrager, and Nelson Tebbe, they can tell me if I'm pronouncing that right. They have written two recent articles, one in the New York Times, which is called The Quiet Demise of the Separation of Church and State, and another in The Atlantic called The Separation of Church and State is Breaking Down Under Trump. Micah Schwartzman is the Hardy Cross Dillard Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. Nelson Tebbe is a professor at Cornell Law School. And Richard Schrager is the Per Bowen Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law.
And we have Professor Schwartzman and Professor Tebbe on the phone with us today. And first, I wanted to tell you, gentlemen, how much your articles have meant. We have about 32,000 members around the country, and I feel like almost all of them sent me an excited email when they read your article in the New York Times, The Quiet Demise of the Separation of Church and State, that ran on June 8th and that we got permission to reprint in our own periodical. And so thank you so much for sounding the alarm.
You're welcome. It's terrific to be here.
Did I say your names right?
You did.
Tebbe. Okay, very good. So what prompted this? You've been studying state church separation for years, obviously, but this PPP program is something entirely different, your article points out.
Nelson, you want to go first?
Sure. So we're paying attention to the role of religion in the coronavirus epidemic kind of more generally. And when we saw the congressional effort to help small businesses, we were, like many Americans, cheered by that development. And then we saw that the small businesses that were being helped by the PPP program were included religious organizations, not just, you know, religious nonprofits like schools and hospitals, but churches themselves, actual houses of worship were receiving funds. And not only were they receiving taxpayer dollars, but they were receiving them for core religious activities like prayer and worship and theological instruction. And they were receiving those funds in an incredible scale, unlike any kind of funding of religion program that we've seen in this country previously. So we thought it was necessary to kind of take stock of that development and alert Americans to the fact that it was happening.
Well, you announced that this is a nearly complete breakdown of the principle of the separation of church and state.
I would add to what Nelson said, and the breakdown is that, in the past, the court had been careful to note a distinction in funding programs where the money was used for secular purposes, even if money was designated to go to a religious organization, say a social service provider, a soup kitchen, or a hospital, or what have you, the money was used for non-religious activities. The difference here is that the money is going directly from the government to a religious organization to be used for religious purposes, and that just crossed lots of legal doctrinal lines that we think had not been crossed before. And part of the reason we wrote the New York Times article was because it seemed like no one noticed. Like the policy happened, the money went out, a huge amount of money went out. Right? PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, is $670 billion. I mean, the magnitude of the program is just beyond anything that we've seen in the past. And obviously that's because of the relief effort for the coronavirus. But there just seemed to be no public reaction to this development. And we thought it was important to note that and to observe it.
Well, we appreciate that. We were reacting. I know state church groups were reacting, but there's not that many Americans who belong to them. And I wondered if you could go into the history of separation of church and state, why this is so shocking.
There have been several kinds of phases of doctrine on a constitutional level about the separation of church and state. But without simplifying too much, there wasn't really a lot of activity as a legal matter in the early republic on the question of separation of church and state. And the main reason was that the Establishment Clause, which is the provision of the First Amendment that enforces what we think of as the separation of church and state, was not applicable to the states until the 1940s, when the Supreme Court started to hand down decisions where it was enforcing the Establishment Clause against the states. And for the first part of the court's jurisprudence, which, you know, kind of very loosely marked the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, the Warren Court was instilling a fairly strict separation of church and state. And even into the early 1970s, the court was setting pretty strict limits on the ability of funds to flow, especially to public schools. As Micah said, the rule that was developed was that any aid that flowed to religion had to be driven by a secular purpose. It couldn't have an outsized religious effect, and it couldn't effectuate an entanglement between religion and government, and that rule that test was applied in a manner that effectuated a fairly strict separation of church and state. Then in the 1980s and 90s, under the Rehnquist Court, which was more conservative and more favorable toward religion, that kind of regime started to loosen a bit, so that aid was flowing more liberally to religious organizations. But there is still a sense, and this remains governing law today, as Micah mentioned, that tax dollars can't flow to religious uses themselves. In fact, the currently governing law on the Establishment Clause prohibits tax dollars from flowing to religious uses under a decision called Mitchell against Helms. The PPP program flaunts that rule, but no one expects that if this program were challenged in the United States Supreme Court, that the court would actually strike it down. More likely, the justices would rule that aid that flows in a manner that's neutral as to religion, that doesn't prefer one religion over another, or doesn't prefer religion over non-religion, and is secular in content, would satisfy the Establishment Clause. That's where we think the doctrine is heading.
So, Professor Schwartzman, can't the churches argue that their businesses too, like anybody else, and they are subject to the governmental pandemic regulations of social distancing, so they're being harmed just like anyone else by this? Can't they argue that they are equally entitled like any other business?
I think they can, and they have made that argument. And in fact, I think some religious organizations that are sympathetic to separation of church and state have said, look, this is not normal times, right? This is a very unique kind of situation. The government has effectively shut us down, or at least many state governments have shut down religious organizations, including houses of worship. And they're, like other nonprofits, they're suffering, right? They've had to lay people off. Their budgets are being crunched like other organizations. They have revenue losses. And they're part of the economy, too. So there's a powerful argument, I think, to be made under those circumstances. But as we say in the New York Times article, what made us worried was that the logic that the government used to support the inclusion of religious organizations without any constraints was not specific to these circumstances. The argument that the Small Business Administration used when it lifted its regulations governing funding of religious organizations was not there are specific public health regulations that are harming religious organizations like other groups. It was a much more general argument that religious groups have to be treated like all others, regardless of the circumstances, whenever there's a general public benefit that's being delivered. And again, that just went far beyond the doctrine that we have, even under the Supreme Court's most recent decision in Espinoza, which involves school financing. So the question is PPP, is the logic of funding of religious organizations under PPP something that's specific to current events given the pandemic, or is what the government has done used this health crisis in order to move a major change in our understanding of the law governing funding of religious organizations? And our concern was it's really the latter. I mean, it was an opportunity to move the law, not so much a response to this particular set of events, however understandable that response would be.
We are talking with law we'll hold that thought, Professor Tebbe. We are talking with Michael Schwartzman and Nelson Tebbe, who are both professors of law, about the unprecedented money going for religious purposes to churches. And when we come back, we'll get that response from you, Professor Tebbe, and we'll talk also about the disparate treatment of Planned Parenthood versus the Catholic Church and other hypocritical developments here. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
I'm Dan Barker. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at ffrf.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we are talking, with law professors Micah Swartzman, University of Virginia, and Nelson Tebbe, Cornell University, about their articles in The Atlantic, The Separation of Church and State is Breaking Down Under Trump, and their definitive piece in the New York Times, The Quiet Demise of the Separation of Church and State. And this is about the unprecedented tax money flowing to religion for religious purposes under the pandemic Paycheck Protection Act. And we were just speaking about this question of, isn't there a fairness issue with that churches should have access to these funds? And I know Professor Tebbe, that you had a response on that.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Micah said before the break that the Supreme Court is moving toward a rule that not only allows churches to receive funding on the same terms as secular groups, but also requires it, that when the government provides funding or sets up a funding program, it actually violates the Constitution to exclude religious groups from that program.
So the Trinity Lutheran case, for example, was starting to go in that direction.
Yeah, and the SBA, when it crafted the regulations that included houses of worship in the PPP program, pointed to Trinity Lutheran and said, you know, not only do we think it's permissible to include clergy in this salary protection program, but we think it's required by the U.S. Constitution.
Well, that's a total change from our history of state-church separation.
Now, what we saw was an act of Congress, the CARES Act, that did not talk about giving money to religion. This was the implementation by the Small Business Administration. Is that correct?
Well, it's what the CARES Act did was provide funding for nonprofits. It included nonprofits and other businesses. And within the Paycheck Protection Program, nonprofits were authorized. And the legislation itself doesn't exclude religious organizations. It just allows all 501c3s. But SBA had regulations on the books that would have excluded certain kinds of funding for religious organizations. And it said those regulations were inconsistent with the court's decisions, and here implicitly Trinity Lutheran. But then it did something else. Then the SBA also lifted an affiliation requirement. That is, that if you're a small business but you're affiliated with a large organization, which is defined as an organization with 500 or more employees, then you would not be eligible for funding. And the Small Business Administration said that that rule would be waived for religious organizations. So given the way that PPP was actually implemented, it turns out that not only did religious groups get to come in on equal terms with other secular nonprofits and other types of businesses. In fact, they got favorable treatment under the SBA's implementation of its rules.
So that brings us to the article that you had in The Atlantic, in which you discuss Planned Parenthood, for example, versus the Catholic Church getting funds. Could you talk about that?
Maybe Professor Schwartzman wants to talk about that one.
Yeah, just to follow on, so these are two examples of organizations that are on either, that could be anyway, on either side of the rules that we're talking about. I say could be because Planned Parenthood thinks its local centers are, in fact, eligible. But just to give you the way the argument goes, the idea is that if you're a small religious congregation, say a parish or a temple someplace, and you have under 500 employees, but you're affiliated according to the SBA's rules with an organization that's larger than 500 employees, if you have an affiliation with a national organization of some kind, then you would not be able to get money. But the SBA lifted that rule. So groups, we think, like the Catholic Church, but maybe other religious organizations as well, received a lot of money under PPP as a result of lifting that affiliation requirement. But the SBA turned around and used those affiliation rules to claim that Planned Parenthood has to return the money that its local centers received. So local Planned Parenthoods, about 38 of them or so, received in total something like $80 million. And SBA has claimed that those local centers are affiliated with National Planned Parenthood, which has more than 500 employees, and so they're not eligible and have to return all the money. And so because Planned Parenthood is a secular organization and not a religious one, it doesn't get the benefit of SBA's religious exemption. And so religious organizations get this benefit. If Planned Parenthood was religious, it would have no problem. But because it's secular, the Small Business Administration is saying that it has to return all the money that it received under PPP. The result is that the way that it's implemented, religious organizations are treated with enormous favoritism in this exemption.
So shouldn't Planned Parenthood be able to sue?
We think there's a strong constitutional argument. They haven't been, I should say, there isn't litigation over this yet. SBA has written to plan to several local Planned Parenthoods. We know that because the letters were disclosed by SBA. They were made public, and so we know that SBA has made demands on Planned Parenthood to return the money. We don't have litigation in that dispute yet. So if there is litigation, our view is that Planned Parenthood would have a strong constitutional argument on Establishment Clause grounds in that kind of circumstance.
Your Atlantic article points out that there are some senators calling for Planned Parenthood to be prosecuted for fraudulent loan applications, which is really going across the line.
So we've been talking with that was Micah, right? Could we hear from you, Professor Tebbe, about what this is going to mean for the future of separation of church and state?
Yeah, I'd be happy to address that. I mean, I think these developments are hugely consequential. You know, Americans are used to looking to the Supreme Court to define the Constitution for them, and too often that means they miss developments outside the courts that can be equally or even more consequential on the meaning of the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. And some of these developments in Congress or in the Trump administration, the SBA is part of the Trump administration, are really momentous on the ground, and they're worth paying attention to. I also want to mention that the SBA argues that it exempted religious organizations from the affiliation rule for constitutional reasons, that there would be religious freedom concerns if the affiliation rules were applied to churches and synagogues and mosques. And in particular, they thought that if the PPP funding were applicable to small unaffiliated religions but not applicable to hierarchically organized national churches, that would skew religious freedom by encouraging, giving a massive financial incentive for churches to adopt one form of religious organization over another, and they thought that would be a constitutional problem. And we think that argument is not very strong, but even if it were strong, there's a very simple solution here, which is let's exempt all nonprofits from the affiliation rules. That's really treating everybody equally. It avoids any possible constitutional problems with including religious organizations in this affiliation rule, and it treats everybody equally.
Yeah, and the only difference between all the other 501c3 groups and churches, however, is that churches are excluded by the Internal Revenue Service from filing information returns on what they do with their money. And all other 501c3 groups to retain their tax exemption have to file that Form 990.
Like us, yeah.
So So there's no accountability from churches. At least there's some accountability from nonprofits, but I agree with you.
So we have about a minute and a half left here. Maybe Professor Schwartzman, you have some closing thoughts about this whole big picture here of favoritism to religion.
Yeah, I think increasingly what we're going to see is a regime, a constitutional regime, a framework in which the court requires what it will refer to as equal funding with respect to public benefits. That is, religious groups will have to come in on equal terms with non-religious and secular organizations, whether they're nonprofits or for-profit organizations. And at the same time, the court will require, and Congress may provide, presidential administration may provide exemptions. And so the combination of equality in terms of funding plus exemptions of various kinds is going to create an environment in which religious organizations are going to get the benefit of public funding, but without much of the regulation that attaches to it. And that's going to create a regime of favoritism. And we're seeing that on a huge scale, I think, under PPP.
Well, thank you, Professor Micah Schwartzman and Professor Nelson Tebbe. Tebbe is at Cornell and Schwartzman is at the University of Virginia School of Law. The two of them with Professor Richard Schrager, also of Virginia School of Law, have written some amazing informative articles in the New York Times and the Atlantic about the demise of the separation of church and state. Thank you for joining us today, both of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes, very, very sobering interview there. Thank you for sounding the alarm.
So that's our show for today. We want to thank our producer. We had two producers and engineers today, Noah Gilfillan and Buzz Kemper, producing from Audio for the Arts. Free Thought Radio is produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation, based in Madison, Wisconsin. And we want to say hello to all of you who listen to the broadcast on the air, to WOOM in Philadelphia, to WIDE and WMUU right here in Madison, Wisconsin, in Janesville, Wisconsin, to WADR Community Radio, in College Station in Bryan, Texas, that's where Texas A&M is, to KEOS, in Central Missouri, KOPN in Columbia, Missouri, to Black Sheep Radio, WOOL, Black Sheep Radio in Vermont, New Hampshire. Hello to listeners to WRFI in Ithaca, right there where Cornell is, and in Watkins Glen, New York. And, of course, to all of you thousands of podcast listeners, give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider if you like the show. And tell your friends to visit our show at ffrf.org/radio.
You can ask for more information about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at our website, ffrf.org. You can also just become a member at that donate button. You can support Free Thought Radio, but you can also support all of our litigation and educational efforts to buttress this very besieged wall of separation between state and church. We'd be glad to send you a sample copy of our newspaper, Free Thought Today, and a brochure. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.
Moment of clarity from LeeCamp.net. I remember a time when police officers were like big, chubby, affable types just drinking coffee and throwing old Otis into the drunk tank to give him time to sober up before he stumbled home. But over the past few decades, the police have morphed and mutated into jacked-up Dwayne Johnson-looking motherfuckers who can't turn their heads from side to side without bumping into their own shoulder muscles, raged up on steroids and militarized to the gills. They fully expect every traffic stop to be an all-out war, a Waco on wheels, and they've armed themselves accordingly. And now NDAA makes it so that the Defense Department can donate surplus military equipment to local police. According to The Guardian, tanks, grenade launchers, armored vehicles, and assault rifles are some of the trinkets that are passed along to the cities around America. Recently, a small county in upstate New York got a 20-ton mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, or MRAP. But that's understandable because in upstate New York, you never know when you might have to deal with a bushy-tailed squirrel. All right, those evil vermin know no mercy. None. $546 million of military equipment has been distributed to local authorities in 2012 alone. And keep in mind who ends up behind the wheel of these goddamn tanks. It's the same dude who gave you a ticket for making a left turn in a left turn lane. I'm not saying all cops are idiots, but some are, and now they have grenade launchers. And the most important point is that when you give local law enforcement these kinds of materials, they aren't going to avoid using them forever, or maybe even for very long. They're going to find a reason to see what the new MRAP can do. Can it blow a hole clean through a Toyota? Only one way to find out. When your only tool is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. That's what they say, right? Well, when your only tool is a tank, then every problem looks like, holy God, it's a Decepticon! When your only tool is racism, then every dark-skinned person looks like a terrorist. When your only tool is drone surveillance, then every movement looks suspicious. When your only tool is bullets, then every problem ends in death. You can see this in the Marvel Universe, too. Storm's only tool is bad weather, so every problem to her looks like something that needs a rainy day. You know, I got this one. No, it requires a rainy day. You're wrong. It needs a rainy day. I'm going to throw a rainy day on this. Okay, look, you dealt with that guy last week who was a poker player, and you throw those cards, and they hurt him, right? You throw the painful cards or whatever the fuck, and it was perfect. You dealt with him. This one needs a rainy day, so this is on me. I'm going to throw a rainy day at it. Same with the Incredible Hulk. He always says Hulk smash. He never says Hulk is just that guy and seeking psychiatric help. Wolverine only has blades, so every problem needs chopping up. Same with the guy who sells the flap chop. Everything needs chopping. Some criminologists say there have been a 1,500% increase in the use of SWAT teams for things that didn't used to require SWAT teams. So I rest my case. And considering the amount of money to be made in producing the weapons of war given to our police departments, we're getting closer and closer to a police industrial complex in which corporations make a buttload of money by outfitting law enforcement to wage war against the American people. But to take the positive point of view just for a minute, I think we can win that war. I think we can kick the American people's ass. You see, the news doesn't cover most of the important stuff, so we'll have the element of surprise on our side. They won't even know what hit them. And then we can march down the street chanting, we're number one. Those of us that are left are number one. Yeah. That's been your moment of clarity from LeeCamp.net. A lot of the information in this episode came from a Guardian article by Michael Schenck and Elizabeth Beavers. Also, if you get a chance, check out the Clarity Collective, where we post activist art, comedy, music of all types. It's at clarity-collective.tumblr.com. That link is in the description, as well as the link to the music here at the end, which is by Kale Sampson. All right, keep fighting.
Perceive a very narrow bandwidth of this reality. What you see in the mirror is not actually you. It's an illusion of perception that gets you confused, because what appears to be solid and what atoms make is really 99.99 empty space. We're vessels. Consciousness uses us tools to observe our free will and gather knowledge through. And I know this probably sounds esoteric to you, but quantum physics has proven that it's actually true.